Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everyone. I want to welcome you all to tonight's roundtable on yesterday's Super Tuesday primaries and what it means for the race for the presidency. My name is Peter Tribowitz. I'm a professor of international relations and the director of the Phelan United States Center here at the LSE, which is hosting tonight's roundtable discussion. So yesterday, Joe Biden and Donald Trump put a lot of points up on the proverbial board, each racking up enough delegates to effectively put the contest away in their respective parties. This is, I think, accurate as of something like 2 o'clock this afternoon, so the numbers are changing a little bit. But basically, when all the votes are counted, Biden will be about 400-some-odd delegates short of what he needs to secure the nomination. Trump is roughly 228 delegates away from doing the same thing. In short, unless something extraordinary happens between now and each party's convention this summer, we're looking at a rerun of the 2020 election contest in November. And so in this respect, Yogi Berra's right, it's deja vu all over again. Whether it plays out like 2020 is another matter. Most national polls are showing Trump right now with somewhere between 2 to 5% edge. But Biden enters the race with a pretty sizable financial advantage. Certainly doesn't have Trump's many legal distractions and problems. And he has the power of the presidency at his fingertips. But both Trump and Biden have vulnerabilities. As the Wall Street Journal put it today, never has America had to choose between two candidates so old or between two so strongly disliked by the opposing party. I think the former is true. I'm not so certain. If you go back to the 19th century, I'm not sure that that's true, but at any rate, it's pretty bad and it's pretty polarized. They also have distinct electoral liabilities, which were on display yesterday, both in the results and in the exit polls. In Trump's case, he's clearly struggling. These are the exit polls from Virginia and North Carolina. He's clearly struggling with college-educated voters. And we saw the same pattern in Iowa, in New Hampshire, and in South Carolina. This is not new. It also dogged him in the 2020 contest, and it could do so again in the general election. In Biden's case, let's see, this is what I wanted to get to. He's having trouble with younger progressive voters. This has appeared in the New York Times this morning. With respect to the uncommitted vote in Minnesota. And as you can see, uncommitted votes were highest in those areas with younger voters. Now, to be sure, uncommitted voters constitute a very small portion of the Democratic electorate, but they could be critical in November, especially in states like Minnesota, where progressive third-party candidates will likely be running. So there's a lot to talk about with respect to yesterday's results, from yesterday's results to where we're headed and what shape this campaign, this contest was going to take, and what factors might determine the outcome in November. And fortunately, we have a crackerjack group of experts here to help us this evening make sense of it all. Briefly, closest to me is Ursula Hackett, who is a reader in politics at Royal Holloway, University of London, and a British Academy mid-career fellow. Sitting next to Ursula is Jason Casellas, who's the John Winnett Visiting Professor of American Government at Oxford and an Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Houston. Next to Jason is Stephanie Rickard, who's a Professor of Government and a faculty affiliate of the Phelan U.S. Center here at LSE. And rounding things out is Mark Landler, the London Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Welcome to all of you. It's great to have you all here. Just a few words about the game plan for tonight, and then we'll get down to business. I've asked each of the panelists to take a few minutes to summarize what they consider to be the big takeaway from Super Tuesday and the race for the presidency thus far. I'll then put a couple questions to them as a group before opening it up to all of you in here in the theater and those of you who are joining us online. Before we could get started, I just want to remind everybody to please put your phone on silent if you haven't already. For those of you joining us online, if you want to put a question to the panelists, just use the Q&A function on Zoom, and we'll be trying to factor or bring those questions into the general discussion. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with, I've asked Ursula to kick things off. So Ursula, what's the big takeaway from yesterday?
Thanks, Peter. Well, I'm sure we were all of us on the edge of our seats yesterday for the sort of nail-biter primaries. You know, who was going to emerge as the front runner? You know, which of the many candidates would come out in front and start to gain the delegates necessary to clinch the nominations? You know, what was going to happen to Dean Phillips? You know, we were all had some serious questions to answer yesterday. I think we can all say that this was probably the least suspenseful Super Tuesday that anyone can remember. But I think that nevertheless, there are some things that we can take from this Super Tuesday contest that might tell us some things about the general election in November and, of course, also about the state of American politics more broadly. So I just wanted to highlight just a few of those things. First of all, this is a story of victors with vulnerabilities on show, very much so, as Peter alluded to in his opening remarks. We've got an unprecedented situation. You've got an incumbent versus a quasi-incumbent, kind of a like a Grover Cleveland in 1892, you mentioned the 19th century. But they are dominating their races, but the parties are by no means unified. So, of course, on the Democratic side, you've got the success of the uncommitted campaign, the no preference. You've got Minnesota, where uncommitted got 19% of the vote. North Carolina, nearly 13% of the vote. These are states that might well be in play in November. You've got on display Biden's vulnerabilities on the Gaza question. With respect to the Republican side, of course, the Haley protest vote wins in Vermont. It garners a fifth, a quarter, a third, even in some of these states, 40% of the Republican vote. So I think we can quite clearly say that, you know, the Republican base is Trump's, but many moderates are very much not on board. Now, I think we can all say that the chances are that they're going to swing behind their respective nominees in come November. But these questions of party unity and uncommitted voters and protest votes really matters because it's likely to be extremely close in November. It was merely 45,000 votes in a few states that denied Donald Trump a second term in 2020. You know, it's going to come down to these margins, perhaps a few thousand votes in some of these swing states. So I think this question about unity really matters. The second thing I take from Super Tuesday is this is an unpopularity contest. I mean, it really is hard to overstate the historical significance, I think, of the fact that Biden has a mere 38% job approval as president. He's 15% percentage points underwater on favorability. Trump is 9 percentage points underwater on favorability. And more generally, Americans are lacking in trust for political institutions of both parties. You've got nearly 30% of Americans saying that they dislike both of the parties. You've got the highest number of people who are really turned off by both sides. And two-thirds who say that they feel exhausted when they're thinking about politics. And I think these questions about lack of popularity and of lack of trust, I think matters not only in the short term, because we're thinking here about who's going to energize those voters in November, but also in the longer term, when we're thinking about the state of American democracy, continued support for those institutions, and the way in which policymaking might proceed in the future in terms of how you proceed in this very a system that has tended to push policymaking towards the state level and towards other venues of contestation rather than the federal level. So I think the unpopularity question really matters. And finally, because I know we have some very, very short amount of time here, just to set things up, I wanted to kind of stress that although this was a done deal, the Super Tuesday contest, we all knew how it was going to turn out, it largely conformed to everyone's expectations, there are still deep uncertainties about the general election going into November. So I think it's not only the things that we're all thinking about here, you know, the legal challenges, of course, that Trump faces, the media environment, the money question, which Peter alluded to as well, the sort of unevenness in terms of fundraising and spending. But also, I think some of these down-ballot races, and I hope that we're going to come on to some of these perhaps in the Q&A that were revealed in the Super Tuesday contest, because the outcome of those down ballot races is going to shape, you know, what will Congress look like, what are the gubernatorial races going to look like, and how is whoever wins in November going to govern in this very fragmented, separated system. So I hope that we can come to some of those down ballot races in a moment. But bottom line for me is the challenges of governance that we've seen, I think, in recent years are going to persist, whoever wins in November, and probably intensify as well.
That's great. Thank you. Jason.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be here. So I want to talk about 5 points. I want to stick to 5 for now. The first thing I want to talk about, and this picks up to what Ursula was just talking about in terms of down-ballot races, I want to make the case that states matter, and what happens in the states matters a great deal, and I'm going to say a little bit more about that in a second. Next, as we were just mentioning, turnout was fairly low for a presidential primary because it was not competitive, right, on either side. And so we haven't seen this situation in quite some time. I remember 2008, there was a very competitive primary between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And so that, you know, generated a lot of turnout. But here we didn't see that. Of course, the rerun or the encore of the 2020 election, we're going to see that. And I want to say a little bit about sort of what's similar and what's different about, you know, these same two candidates running, but in different environments. And then I'll just conclude with some troubles on the horizon for both Trump and Biden, and sort of what may prevent them from having sort of success. So the first point is about states. You know, states matter a great deal, especially if we look at how American government has sort of been very, in many ways, unstable at the federal level. Congress has been dysfunctional, right, in many ways. It was called the broken branch several years ago, and it's even worse than it looks, as some authors have noted. And so with the absence of policymaking at the federal level, states have really stepped up to the plate. And so what that means is who gets elected to state offices matters a great deal, right? And so that's why some of these down-ballot races are super important, and we can talk more in Q&A, but I just want to highlight a few. North Carolina, of course, a state which just nominated a very conservative Republican as the gubernatorial nominee, someone who's sort of very controversial in many ways, right? And so if that person becomes governor, they will set the agenda in that state and make policy in that state in ways that are important, right, for people of that state. And it's important also because what happens in states doesn't just stay in those states, right? There's something we call, political scientists call, policy diffusion. And what we're seeing then is on a host of issues that we're constantly talking about in the media, things like critical race theory, things like about what happens in schools. This is all done at the state level, right? And so this is something I think we often overlook. it matters, of course, who's president, and that's something we're going to talk about, especially those of us living overseas. But you know, who's governor and who's in the state legislatures also matters a great deal. And of course, the presidential election, as we all know, it's not a national election. Yes, it's important to look at the nationwide polls, right? But really, the polls we should look carefully at are the swing state polls. So Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin, Michigan, North Carolina, Georgia, right? And that's sort of, as we get closer to November, I think we should pay more attention to, of course. Yes, the national numbers matter and they'll tell us a lot, but I think it's going to be another close one where we could have a situation in which the winner of the popular vote and electoral vote would be different. And that's something that could have serious repercussions. Next, the slow turnout in the primaries. Again, there's no competition really at the presidential level. We saw that, of course, Haley was able to win in Vermont, but Vermont is not in any way a swing state in the general election. So there is this dissatisfaction that Ursula just mentioned when we're talking about both candidates, right? But this dissatisfaction at the end of the day, sort of, will it translate into significant problems, right? And we'll talk a little bit, hopefully, about a possibility of a formidable third-party candidate. We haven't had one in quite some time. Perhaps Ross Perot, when he ran, got 19% of the vote in 1992. But since then, you know, third-party candidates generally haven't generated a lot of interest. But maybe this year it's going to be different. And we always say that, but maybe it will be. And that's something we'll have to come back to. And as we've mentioned, the majorities of Americans don't want these two candidates, right? So these are two very unpopular candidates. And it's going to be the case in which, you know, voters will vote for the lesser of two evils in many ways. But that's going to be a challenge for turnout and a challenge for both campaigns, really. Because in many ways, getting your voters to the polls is important. And this gets me to the point about troubles for both of these candidates. I think the troubles for Biden, getting voters excited, especially his base, to come out and support him. We mentioned young people are not as excited, right, about the Biden candidacy and his reelection. Also, I think we should look at voters of color, African Americans in particular, and Latinos, right, getting them excited to turn out to vote for President Biden, I think, will be more of a challenge. Biden was Obama's vice president, but he doesn't have the same charisma that Obama had to mobilize many young voters, especially voters of minority communities. And of course, Trump, one of the differences between 2020 and 2024, of course, January 6th. And, you know, the Democratic campaign, the Biden campaign will, I think, campaign very heavily on Trump being a danger to democracy based on his activities and his behavior on January 6th. Whether that's a good strategy or not, we can talk a little bit about later. But I think one of the things that that's different, of course, is that perhaps some voters who voted for Trump in 2020 may be more put off in 2024 because of what he did on January 6th. That's certainly the hope of the Biden campaign, but we'll have to see whether that materializes. And one of the other things I want to mention with troubles for Biden as well is sort of the general trend of working class voters. We know that, of course, college educated voters have really went for Haley and more than Trump. And so Trump has had this problem with college educated voters, especially suburban voters, suburban women in particular. Especially due to the Dobbs decision overruling Roe versus Wade. So that may, I think, be an important issue for many women. But I think one of the other issues is with Democrats, it's sort of the erosion of the working class, sort of non-college educated voter. And we see that with the white working class, but also with, to a lesser extent, but still there, with the black working class and the Latino working class. That there has been this sort of erosion of support for the Democrats. And so I think one of the challenges for the Biden campaign is to be able to speak to the working class Americans, right, in a way that will get them excited to vote for the president's reelection. And I think that's one of the big challenges that Biden will have. both candidates are, the age issue is going to be an issue for both of these candidates, and I think that's something that everyone sort of knows about, but are not as willing to maybe talk about publicly. But the campaigns will have to deal with this, especially it seems to be something that the Biden campaign seems to have more concerns about, I think, because there is a sense in which Biden's sort of age is more of an issue for him than Trump's age. They're only about 3 years apart. But that's something that I think will be an issue in this campaign. But we do have about 8 months to go, right? So campaigns can change. Events on the ground are very fluid. And when you have a race that's this close, and that will be this close, a lot of external events can make the difference. And so I look forward to having more of a conversation and having some Q&A. So thank you.
That's great, Jason. Yep. We're going to want to return, I think, to the issue of the candidates and the issue that Ursula flagged about how highly polarized the electorate is. But before we get there, Stephanie, your take.
Thanks, Peter. I mean, there's two things we know. We know the contest is going to be very close, and it's going to be contentious. And that closeness of the election, it's leading the candidates not to try to maximize the number of votes they get across the country, but to maximize the votes they get in these swing states. Because of this feature of the U.S. electoral system, the Electoral College, it gives sort of extra weight to these key states. So Wisconsin, it was a key state for Biden in 2020. The vote differential was 20,000 votes. That's how close it is, 20,000 votes. So this contest will similarly be very close and concentrated in these key swing states. But it may be even closer than we think it is, because it looks like, from the results from Super Tuesday, there may be shy non-Trump voters. So Trump, the polling data showed Trump winning Virginia by 60 points. But he only won by 30. The polling data, less good in Vermont, it's less well polled, but it showed Trump winning by 30 points. He actually lost to Haley, just about. So maybe, you know, we talk about shy Tories in the UK a lot, but maybe there are shy non-Trump voters, voters who are Republican, whose friends are Republican, who are unwilling to kind of say, you know, I might not vote for Trump. But when they're in the ballot box, when they're at the ballot box, they're actually not willing to cast their vote for Trump. So these big leads that Trump seems to have in some places, we may not see them actually materialize at the ballot box. So the race may be even closer than we think it's going to be. So there are two things that I took away from Super Tuesday that I'm really going to watch going forward. The first is, where do Haley's voters go? Haley did very well amongst independents. She did very well amongst college-educated voters, or I should say relatively well, amongst college-educated voters. Where do they go? Who do they turn to? I think that's a big question that I'm going to watch going forward. The other thing that I think is curious is the number of uncommitted voters in Democratic primaries. So my home state is Colorado, so of course I have to talk about Colorado. In Colorado, 40,000 Democratic primary voters said they were uncommitted. So these are hardcore Democrats, right? If you turn out in a primary election, you're really a partisan. Right? You are committed to this party, and yet 40,000 of them were not willing to say, I'm behind Biden. So I think that's a problem for Biden, particularly because it's going to be super close. Now, Colorado is not a swing state. Colorado in 2020 went 55% for Biden, so it's not a swing state. But it might be indicative of some concerns that loyal Democrat partisans have about the candidate. They may not be willing to cast their vote for somebody else, but they might not turn out. And in such a tight, close election, turnout could be really a critical factor in the outcome of this election. I'll stop there.
Great, Stephanie. Mark.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be back. I was here 4 years ago, although sitting behind a computer screen because we were about to go into a pandemic lockdown. Since my colleagues up here covered a lot of the political trends very well, I thought I would just zero in on two things that I think are worth pointing out in March of a general election, of an election year. And one is, not to get too hung up on polls, There's been a whole raft of polls in the last week that have shown, as Peter said earlier, a consistent lead for Donald Trump. And, you know, Democrats are freaking out over this, if you haven't noticed. And there's almost a bit of defeatism kicking in that it's inevitable, we're facing Donald Trump part two. I just wanted to point out, as a matter of historical interest, that at this point in the 2016 race, Hillary Clinton had a 10 percentage point polling lead over Donald Trump. At this point in the 1992 election, Ross Perot, a third-party candidate, had a comfortable lead over the incumbent president, George H.W. Bush, and the Democratic challenger, Bill Clinton, who had 25% in the polls and went on to win that election. So polls are important because they do tell you about what voter sentiment is. But at this stage in a presidential race, they're actually not predictive of all that much. One of the interesting things about polls, I was chatting with a professor that I was at a dinner with the other day who studies presidential polling, and he made the point that in the early months of a presidential election, before voters begin to pay that much attention day to day to an election, polls tend to be driven by vaguer notions of personality, appeal, and you know, maybe things like Biden's age or the fact that Donald Trump, for all his foibles, appears quite energetic on the campaign trail. But that as you trace polls closer and closer to election day, fundamentals tend to kick back in, with the major fundamental being the state of the economy. So if history is a guide here, a strong economy, a moderating inflation rate, a booming stock market, a housing market that's beginning to show life again, all should begin to lift Joe Biden over the coming months, and put him, you know, in a much more competitive position. And in the view of some people, should suggest that even now, today, he's still on paper the, you know, slight favorite in this campaign as an incumbent running with a strong economy. I wanted to just make a couple other points. One is there's an old line in politics that I always remember every 4 years, which is Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. And I think it's very appropriate yet again this year, because it goes to the question that Stephanie just alluded to, which is, are these uncommitted Democrats the equivalent of, you know, the girl or boy who turned you down for a date and is never going to change their mind? Or are they going to say, Joe Biden's the only game in town and I'm a Democrat and I'm going to turn out and vote? Because we do know from history that a lot of Republicans do tend to fall in line, even with a primary candidate that they didn't support. So that then goes to the question of whether Donald Trump is the candidate that is the exception to this rule. Are these Nikki Haley voters so opposed and so repelled by Donald Trump that they either won't vote or might even cross party lines and vote for Biden? So that's a really interesting question too. And then I guess the last point I'd make in the category of what makes this election unprecedented. Well, it's almost unprecedented because it has the same two people running against each other. But that also raises another thing that's quite unprecedented, which is the pattern of almost every presidential election is that it becomes a referendum on the incumbent. But in this race, you effectively, de facto, have two incumbents running against each other. And the president has indicated already in interviews that he plans to make the election a referendum on his challenger. In other words, January 6th, threat to democracy. This guy is corrosive of institutions and you know, will lead us down a road to ruin. And that's a really interesting, that's going to be a very interesting test to watch how it plays out. What that means is that Biden might spend less time talking about the fact that he's got a robust economy, a booming stock market, and all these other things, and make it more about stoking fear about his challenger. And I think that's an interesting strategy. There are already some very prominent Democratic strategists, including David Axelrod, who advised Barack Obama in two successful election campaigns who've raised issues about this and said, Americans, you know, it's not that they're over January 6th, but they're not obsessing on January 6th. They're obsessing about gas prices and food prices and, you know, the value of their house. So it's perhaps a risky strategy to try to turn much of your campaign against the challenger. But, you know, you could argue it worked the first time when their roles were reversed. And I think that Biden is set to try it again. So I think that's going to be a very interesting thing to watch out. And with that, I'll just turn it back to you guys and get into Q&A. Thanks very much.
That's great. You know, all of these points are fantastic. There's a number of different things to pick up on. I mean, just one quick observation. People forget, too, that Obama faced uncommitted voters as well. And the vote, uncommitted vote, if I believe this is correct, was higher in Michigan under Obama than it was this time. So, you know, this is goes to your point that Democrats don't fall in line, at least not right away. I want to push just a little bit on the Biden strategy. So Biden has the candidate. The White House has the candidate they want in Donald Trump. This is who they want. I mean, it's been clear from the get-go that they think he is that they match up best against him, certainly better than they would against a younger candidate like a Nikki Haley. And you know, there's a lot to be said for, it seems to me, pushing on this, you know, the January 6th line of argument. And I think one of the reasons, though, they're moving in that direction as well is because they're just not getting a bump. He is not getting a bump from the economy. I mean, it is pretty remarkable, given GDP growth in the United States, given how inflation has fallen, and you can even consumer confidence, when you look at the consumer confidence index, that's gone up the last few months, certainly the last 2 months. I think it's the last 3 months at this point. But it is not showing up in the polls. And I think, you know, one question that it raises is, are we seeing something, is this just like a lagging indicator? It seemed like you were thinking maybe a few months from now it shows up. It starts to show up. Not if he's hammering on something else. It seems to me he needs to be reminding voters of how it's growing. Or is there something deeper going on where somehow, like this measure has become like a proxy for partisanship in the United States, so that you just can't move people on it?
I'll take a crack at it, then yeah. I want to hear what my colleagues have to say. I think that it's easy to forget that advanced economies didn't really deal with a serious bout of inflation for decades. And so I think that the lagging impact of a sustained period of near double-digit inflation has really, you know, left a mark in the minds of many voters. And it's also, you know, it's such a simplistic thing to point out, but just because inflation fell from 6% to 2.5% or 3% doesn't mean the prices aren't still going up. They're just going up more slowly. So if you go and buy a quart of milk, it's still going to cost you more. It's just going to cost a little less more than it did 6 months ago. And, you know, ditto for filling up your car. So I think that I would argue, but the political scientists may disagree with me, and I'd love to hear the argument, that a lot of this has to do with the nature of the economic problem we have right now. The stickiness of inflation can't be underestimated. And, you know, to talk about the UK as an example, I think one of the only things that Rishi Sunak has gotten absolutely right in the past year is to hammer away at the corrosive effect of inflation on virtually every part of the economy and on the psyche of voters. And, you know, it's a reason that in this country the government made cutting the inflation rate in half probably its number one goal. And I think that that is a large part of what Biden is dealing with. And the question is, in this 8 months we have left, does he finally shake the lingering ghost of inflation, or does a 2% inflation rate going through the summer still feel bad to people, in which case he may never get credit for a decent economy?
Right. Stephanie, any thoughts?
I hope it's a lag, because one of the most consistent results we have in political science is that people vote based on the economy.
Right.
So if that's not true, we have a lot of thinking to do, rethinking our models. But I'll make 2 points. One, those good positive numbers that you quoted, they're unevenly distributed geographically. Mm-hmm. Not everywhere in the states is doing that well. Nevada still has an unemployment rate of 5.3%. This is a key swing state, and they're hurting. There are areas that are being left behind, right? They don't see their local economy doing well. So that may be part of the story. The national economy may be hiding a lot of big geographic variation. And the last point I'd make is that we see increasingly people learn about at least the national economy, not their own experience with their own job or their local economy, but the national economy from the media. And so when we consume media based on our political preferences, we're hearing very different things about the national economy. So it could just be real polarization on where we get our information about the economy.
Additional thoughts on this?
I agree with all those points. I mean, most Americans live paycheck to paycheck. And when we talk about the stock market, you know, many working class people, it just doesn't compute. And I think the simple point that Trump will make is, look, when I was president, a gallon of milk cost this much, and now it costs more. And, you know, things were great when I was president, they're not so great now. And it's a very simple argument, and one that, you know, that obviously those of us in this room can say, well, no, well, what about, you know, the rates of inflation and whatnot? But again, I think that's the key point that I made earlier about speaking to working class people, right? People who live paycheck to paycheck, who, you know, they notice when they go to the grocery store and they have to pay a little bit more, it really affects them. And I think that's why the administration, Biden, needs to talk more about how is he going to deal with this problem of inflation, deal with the economy, and that's, I think, that's his challenge, right? Trying to convince those working class voters that he's working on solving these problems.
Yeah. And I think that challenge is exacerbated, of course, by the fact that the way that people have consumed information has changed even since 2020. I mean, that the media environment is changing so rapidly, the segmentation in terms of the ways in which people actually access their news. And so, you know, that's an additional communication challenge on top of everything else, on top of the question of how you reach people who are actually having these everyday experiences of things being very expensive. It's just that there's been this negativity in terms of the media focus on the economy, and also how you actually turn that around. I think that's a very, very difficult, ask.
What do you guys make of, like, you've all described it's highly polarized. I think everybody here agrees this is likely to be a very close election, probably decided by, I mean, last time, Ursula, you mentioned, I mean, it was Arizona and Georgia, basically 40,000 votes that determine the outcome. But even if you're, you know, we're probably talking about, you know, I mean, it's crazy. It's like 200,000 voters that are really, like, in play, in a sense, right, in these Michigan and Wisconsin and Minnesota, maybe Pennsylvania as well. I mean, it makes me wonder about, to just pick up a point that Jason, I think, raised, when it's that tight, I mean, a third party candidate doesn't have to be a Ross Perot picking up 19%. I mean, as we learned in Florida in 2000, it could be the equivalent of a Ralph Nader picking up just barely 5% or even less. I mean, what do you think about, like, I mean, we've got a few third-party candidates. There's Kennedy, there's Stein, right, perhaps running, Cornell West. These are people that they pick up, like, 2% of the vote. Yeah.
Could I just, before we leap in on the third-party questions, I think this is really crucial, I just wanted to address the question about the uncommitteds, because you mentioned, Peter, you know, you're quite right. If we contextualize the number of uncommitteds in these Democratic primaries, they are comparable to Obama, and in fact, in some cases, less than some of the uncommitted or no preference voters that Obama had in 2012. Mm. But I think that the question, the reason why we need to pay attention to these things is not just because we're all searching for things, to latch onto here, but because the margins are small, so tight. And you think about, and the distribution of those uncommitted, I think, is important as well, because this is a campaign that was launched largely in protest of the Gaza stance with the Biden administration. The number of people in Michigan who are Arab American or and also that there's Minnesota is also a conglomeration of Arab Americans. It's about 200,000, I heard. And these numbers are exactly the numbers that they can't afford to lose in some of these states, right? So they're tiny, there are these small margins in some of these swing states. This is where the uncommitted question can really come into play. So I just wanted to flag that. But I think you're absolutely right to contextualize it. You know, it's not unusual in some recent history, in some recent contest.
But this can also work against Donald Trump. I mean, Kennedy entering the race, it's not obvious that it hurts Biden more than it hurts Trump. If you've got, as you were pointing out, I think you all pointed out, I mean, Nikki Haley's voters are going to be in play, right? These independent voters, or maybe they were some moderate Democrats that crossed over in Virginia where they were able to do that. It's not a question, it's kind of a question, it's a comment. I mean, should we be really focused on this question of third parties in the mix here? And what is it that somebody like Biden or Trump can do with respect to that? Yeah.
Choose their vice presidential candidate wisely. for Trump, he knows he's in trouble in the suburbs with independents, with college educated. Right. What does he do? Cleverly choose a vice presidential candidate that can scoop up those Haley votes, that can appeal to those constituents. Now, I'm not saying that he'll do that, but that would be a way to try to peel off some of these independent people who might otherwise vote for a third party candidate.
Well, he's quite capable of doing that. I mean, the last time, in 2016, he thought he needed to consolidate the evangelical vote, and it had something to do with the vice presidential choice, right? So, yeah. I mean, Biden doesn't, I think, have the same kind of flexibility. Yeah.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So, we're going to open it up to questions. If you just raise your hand, I'll have the usher come to you. If you would just briefly introduce yourself, maybe if you're a student here at LSE, what program you're in. We'll start with a woman back there on the in the black sweater.
Hi, thank you so much for this. My name is Elle, I'm from New Jersey, and I just wanted, my question, I've been thinking about it all day, is about the vice president selection, just because I think it is so crucial to this election. Biden doesn't have the same flexibility. He's already committed to Kamala Harris, and she is very unpopular, and I think she faces a different kind of unpopularity that even Joe Biden faces, which puts Trump in an interesting position to, I hate to say it, do something reasonable. Do I think that's going to happen? Maybe not, but if you could speak more to that, I'd be really interested to hear.
Take this gentleman right over here.
Good evening, John. I'm a retired lawyer. My question is, how do you think immigration is going to play out in this contest? And if I can be greedy and ask a second question, is Biden's apparent physical and mental decline a serious problem here?
And we'll take, and that immigration question right now is actually polling higher than the economy is. Chris, can you give us we have a question online?
Thank you. Just to say, we have people on the platform from the US, on the online platform from the US, Argentina, France, Luxembourg, Australia, Bangladesh, Norway, Poland, China, Denmark, Latvia, the Netherlands, and Zimbabwe. And we just wanted to give a quick shout out as the US Center and welcome the students and teachers from St. Anne's Catholic High School for Girls who have joined us tonight in person. We have a question online from Bruno Dunder, who asks, who's an LSE student, who asks, given the upcoming US election, how do you anticipate the State of the Union address influencing voter sentiment and potentially swaying undecided voters? Thank you.
Immigration, the age factor.
Well, can I jump in on the age factor? Because I think it kind of links to the question about what should we expect in the State of the Union. I would argue the State of the Union is going to be most important for what it shows about Biden's ability to stand behind a lectern for an hour to 90 minutes and speak with vigor and, you know, fluidity, because people have a lot of doubts about that. I mean, there's been a couple of recent events that Biden has chosen to skip, most notably an interview that presidents have normally given on the day of the Super Bowl, which Biden's now not done twice in a row. And I think it's raised legitimate concerns about whether his own staff is trying to keep him away from the cameras because of worries that he's going to come across as halting, as whispery, as weak. So I think the State of the Union, if I was to bet sitting here today, that a lot of the analysis will be about look and feel, how he presents himself, as much as what his program is. You know, I mean, after all, he'll come out and speak about a fairly impressive legislative agenda. He's gotten quite a lot of things done. He has a strong economy. He's got, as we said earlier, a strong set of arguments against his opponent. And all of that will be in the laundry list of the speech. But I think the speech will fundamentally be about how he looks and how he sounds. To answer the question the gentleman asked, though, and I preface this by saying none of this may matter. I covered the White House for 6 years during the Obama presidency and traveled with Joe Biden and still am in touch with people who work for Biden. I'm not persuaded that his mental faculties have changed all that much. You know, he suffers from every 81-year-old's habit of forgetting names, which honestly I now do too, and I'm a lot younger than 81. You know, I do believe that it's when people say that in meetings he's still quite informed and plugged in, I think that's probably true. It's also true that physically he's in actually very good shape for an 81-year-old because he's a good athlete. He's very slim. He doesn't drink. He never smoked. His last medical report was, for a man of his age, a very strong report. I say all that, and then I say, why doesn't it matter? It doesn't matter because it's in the eye of the beholder. It's what the public thinks. So all that may be true, and people will still think he's too old and past it. So I think that a very big challenge for the White House, which will begin with the State of the Union address, is to see whether they can turn that narrative around. I'll point out that I think it was 2 years ago or a year ago in the State of the Union address, a not much younger Joe Biden picked a sort of a direct fight with Republicans during the State of the Union address and sort of turned the table on his opponents. And by all accounts, it was a great State of the Union address for him. Likewise, in presidential debates, people always talk about how Joe Biden, he's too prolix, he talks too much, he's gaffe prone. He's won virtually every debate he's ever been in. Because I think he's a bit of a stealth debater. He's actually quite tactical and nasty when he feels like it. He completely dismantled Paul Ryan in a vice presidential debate years ago. He did fine against Donald Trump in their debates in the last general election. So all this by way of saying that's what the White House's challenge is. I think they actually have more raw materials there than people realize. But it's going to be very interesting how they design events in a way that brings out what he's still got and, you know, minimizes the risk of things he doesn't have anymore.
I want to follow up on that, but I want to get the rest of you in here. So, Stephanie.
I'd like to address the immigration question. Yeah. I think we will hear a lot about immigration in the campaign, in part because when pollsters are asking voters, what are you most worried about? They say immigration. Above the economy, yeah. I mean, above Ukraine, that's what they say they're worried about. So the candidates are going to respond to that. It's particularly important in one of the key swing states, Arizona. I was just in Arizona a couple weeks ago. You cannot imagine how many Border Patrol agents are everywhere in that state. So it's visual, it's impactful, people are talking about it. I saw data that under Biden, actually, the number of detentions at the border has increased.
Well, at least recently,
it's going down. Okay, so he's active on the topic, but they're going to try to use it as a wedge issue.
I think it was the last State of the Union last year. He went after them over the Republicans over Social Security. I mean, what he should do is he should go after him over immigration and turn the tables and say, look, I put a program before you that basically has everything you've asked for in it, and you won't vote for it, right? So you either want to fix the problem, or you're just playing politics, I mean, and try to turn the tables. So, yeah, I mean, I think he's got a, he might put it together with what Mark is suggesting, the State of the Union.
But it's interesting, is immigration related to the economy? There's a lag, and Americans start to feel the economy is doing better, does that minimize their concerns about immigration?
No, I would just say that immigration is a very important issue in Texas as well. The governor, Governor Abbott, has really staked his whole governorship on this issue. And that's why I wouldn't be surprised if Trump wants to double down on this issue by choosing Abbott as his running mate, as his vice presidential running mate. I'm not making a prediction, but maybe that could happen if he wants to continue focusing on this issue, which he clearly does. That's what he ran on in 2016, right? But I think Biden, as you say, he has to confront the issue. He can't just let Republicans, especially Trump and Abbott, sort of dominate the conversation by saying, look, you know, the administration is not doing anything on this issue, and it's obviously something that many people in Texas, Arizona, and other states clearly think of it as an important issue for them.
I just add very quickly that they set a record in December for apprehensions at the southern border, right? Over 250,000.
Let's take another round of questions. How about the gentleman back up there?
Hi, I'm Cabby. I'm an LSC alumni. I'm interested in kind of young people in general and their electoral stances, considering what's on the screen right now. But the audience here today is broadly young, politically engaged, generally interested in foreign policy as well, I'd assume. And that overlaps pretty well with kind of, again, what we're seeing on the screen. And I would also imagine it overlaps pretty well with the type of people that would, if we were in the States, be knocking on doors, campaigning, volunteering for campaigns. I guess retail politics in that sense is kind of dying, but I wanted to know what effect do you think like the Gaza issue will have on motivating people to volunteer and actually engage in the political process that way, and what effect that will have on the election.
Okay, how about down right here? And then I'll come right to you right next, yeah.
Hi, I'm David, I'm a master's student in IR from Atlanta, Georgia. I wanted to ask if y'all can speak to how the down ballot races might affect, like we've seen Senator Sinema drop out of the Senate race in Arizona yesterday, and also the Republican candidate who won for North Carolina being very not exactly the person you want to be the nominee if you're the Republican Party.
And right there, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Freya. I'm an undergraduate student here. I'm from Massachusetts, and I'm a researcher with the Fallon Center. And my question was actually the exact same. It was about how Kyrsten Sinema's departure is going to affect the Arizona race.
And Chris, we'll take one from online.
This question is from someone who prefers to remain anonymous. Could Trump's challenge with independent voters become insurmountable if he receives a criminal conviction before Election Day? Thank you.
So that's one of the known unknowns, right? A possible conviction. It looks like if it happens, it's going to be it'll be over Stormy Daniels. Somebody want to speak to the conviction? I mean, it is, when you look at the polls, right, I mean, it's about a third of Republicans in these exit polls are saying they will not vote for Donald Trump if he is convicted, if he's a convicted felon. Now, you know, I don't know whether that carries up, but that's a striking number. Mark, you look like you're ready to go.
Yeah. I think the simplistic answer is there's convictions and there's convictions, which you just alluded to. The way it appears that the cases are lining up, the one he's most likely to face a verdict on is the payment of hush money to a porn star, which is a case that it's almost impossible to even say it without laughing, right? I mean, there's this sort of an element of absurdity to the whole thing, even though there's a serious legal issue. It's not the only one that there are civil cases that could also and are likely to come to a conclusion during this period. But, you know, in this regard, the Supreme Court did Trump a big favor a few days ago by putting off its decision on his immunity until April, which probably means that the big federal cases that Jack Smith is bringing would begin but not reach a verdict, and may indeed not begin because they might have to suspend hearings so quickly that they would just decide to put them off until after the election. The one kind of wild card in this, I think, is the Georgia case, where it remains to be seen whether the prosecutor in that case is basically going to be forced to be taken off the case, which would then lead to a long delay there. And the reason that's important is it's a state case, as is the Stormy Daniels case. So convictions in those cases are ones that presumably would stick regardless of whether Donald Trump is elected president. If he's elected president, there's a sort of a legal issue that's unsettled about whether he can either simply order the Justice Department to drop the federal cases if they haven't been decided yet, or pardon himself if he's been convicted of either of those, the second of which is the one, of course, on security, violating security clearances. At this moment, everything you said is right. There are a significant percentage of voters who say that a felony conviction would change their vote. The problem I see is that the ones that are most likely to be damaging to him are least likely to be decided before the election.
Go ahead, Ursula.
I would just add, I mean, Mark mentioned some of these civil cases because, you know, those are the ones where these huge, huge financial penalties are being handed down right now. And this is impacting the race. So I think the most interesting question here is, you know, you're thinking about the Engeren, Arthur Engeren, the New York judge who hands down $350 million, is it?
$450 million.
The civil fraud, right?
The interest.
the crazy Trump-hating judge. But also, of course, the E. Jean Carroll case, the sexual assault case, the libel case, where the penalties have piled up as well, and are significantly draining these coffers, which are already pretty depleted in comparison to the DNC and Biden. I mean, they've got less than half of the cash on hand that the DNC and the Democrats have. So that has got to be part of this story about how the race is shaping up. The question in my mind is, how far is the very clear financial cost being outweighed by maybe some of the benefits of the courtroom appearances, the exposure, the ability to direct the narrative about persecution that maybe is helping the Trump campaign. So it seems to me there's a cost and there's a benefit here. I'm not sure exactly how those are being weighed up, but it seems to me those are really perhaps the most consequential part of the trials, because and of course as Mark says, these criminal cases, if they do come, they're not going to really happen. If they might happen in the middle of the election season, perhaps, but it seems that they're not really going to come to fruition in enough time.
What about these two questions, down ballot and young voters? On the down ballot, I mean, like Texas.
Yeah.
So Colin Allard kind of broken through. Could he actually beat Ted Cruz?
Probably not, but I mean, certainly he's going to run a good campaign and make Ted Cruz work for his reelection. I mean, I think if we look at Texas, another thing that's happened there is the Speaker of the House is a Republican, was sort of a moderate Republican. Mm-hmm. He sort of didn't really sort of do the governor's bidding and do the lieutenant governor's bidding. And so this may sound too Texas for you, but the point is that this Speaker of the House was primaried, and when we say primaried, the Trump wing of the Republican Party in the state ran someone against him, and he has to go into a runoff now. And so he may lose his seat and no longer be Speaker of the House. Not only that, but in Texas, a lot of these primaries in the down-ballot races, you saw the similar dynamic where Republicans who were deemed not conservative enough had challengers that were funded by the state leaders, and many of them lost. So that's going to change a lot of the dynamics, not only in Texas, but you have other states as well where this is happening.
What about in the California race got a lot of attention, right? So we've ended up with Adam Schiff, the Democrat, House Democrat, and Steve Garvey as the Republican candidate, former baseball star. And this was an open primary, and so this has been touted as kind of the vehicle for the future to get cleaner elections, less kind of Machiavellian strategizing, and it sure didn't look that way. you had Schiff doing everything he could to boost Garvey's numbers so that it knocked out other Democrats, right? So, I mean, thoughts about that?
Well, fair play. I mean, it worked, didn't it?
It definitely worked.
And that's a very good use of the top two primary. He managed to maneuver his opponent to give himself the opponent that he wants in the fall, right? Yeah. I was interested in talking about California because I was thinking about some of these House races in California,
yes,
where actually, because this is where the chances for Democratic pickups are pretty substantial. We're talking post-redistricting,
right?
And redistricting is something I'm thinking about a lot at the moment in different parts of the country, but there are at least seven races, I think, where the Democrats have got a realistic chance in some of these Republican-held House seats. They only need four to gain control of the House. I think the California is where they're looking. I think, and New York as well, right? And so I think that's really consequential. And I wanted to also draw attention to some of the down ballot races in Alabama. There's Allen versus Milligan, the Supreme Court held last year. Surprisingly, actually, the Alabama had violated the Voting Rights Act in persistently failing to draw a second majority minority district. And so the court then ordered the state to draw another majority minority district. The state refused, and then they actually are ordered to finally do this. And so there is this unusual circumstance in Alabama where two existing members are facing off against one another, and it looks as if... That's an interesting story, and I think it's a story that we could tell about other parts of the down ballot races as well, where it's about who is the future of the party. Are we talking about the establishment, the more establishment ring? Are we talking more of the sort of ideological wing? Who's winning out? It seems that in the Alabama case, it's Barry Moore who was perhaps more ideological of the two, more conservative of the two, who's actually edged out his competitor, who was also an existing member. So I think there's some interesting stories there about who's not only who's going to win and maybe potentially take the House, which is on this absolute knife edge,
right,
but also what does the party look like going forward as well?
What about just to pick up the point about North Carolina is the one that you raised in the possibility that Mark Robinson is the very controversial character as the Republican candidate. I mean, could Biden flip the state? He lost it last time, right? I mean, one of the things that's interesting, it goes to the youth vote or question as well, is when you drill down, Haley did well in kind of Raleigh-Durham and, so with younger voters there. So it does kind of raise the question of whether there's a... And Trump is very connected to Robinson? It's endorsed them and vice versa. And I don't know. Thoughts on that? Anything else, Deputy? Yeah.
Can I just speak to the Gaza question quickly? Yeah. You're right that particularly in this state, in Minnesota and in Michigan, a percentage of the Democrats that are going and saying, we're not committed, we're not behind Biden, it's because of Gaza. And this is a tough emotive issue, and so these are voters that are that may remain uncommitted, right? And that's a potential challenge for him, particularly in Michigan, where it's a swing state, and it's so close, it's on such a knife edge to have this issue.
What does that lead Biden to try to do on the foreign policy side? I mean, you know, Mark, you've written a lot about foreign policy.
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to say that that there's already evidence of a shift in the White House's tone. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people around Biden would like him to move farther, faster. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that in the last couple of weeks, to come back to the role that Kamala Harris plays in this mm-hmm. administration, that she's kind of setting herself up as an advocate for more of a pro-Palestinian view in internal debates. She took a meeting with Benny Gantz, a member of the Israeli War Cabinet, and put a lot of pressure on him increase the flow of humanitarian aid, to have an immediate ceasefire. You know, the thing about Biden is he's a stubborn fellow because his view is, I've been doing foreign policy since before any of you were born, and I know best. You saw that stubbornness on display in his view about Afghanistan and winding down Afghanistan, and to his own sort of misery because it was chaotic and bad for America's credibility. But this is a different situation. This is where his political survival mm-hmm. is at stake, and my view is that when a politician's survival is at stake, eventually that will win out. And so my assumption, my belief, is that you will see Biden move more and more to a tougher, more challenging position. I think it's also worth pointing out, again, the 8 months between now and the election, we don't really know where the Israel-Hamas conflict is going to be in 8 months. It won't be fixed in 8 months. But we may be in a different phase with major military operations largely wound down and a very complicated stabilization, rebuilding, diplomatic, humanitarian effort underway that could, I'm not going to say diffuse the issue, but it could change the issue. It could change the role that Biden appears to be playing. If you put yourself forward mentally in 8 months and the U.S. is helping to galvanize a diplomatic effort, a humanitarian effort, you know, that's a different story, and it's maybe a story that younger voters and Arab American voters in Michigan and Minnesota could feel much more comfortable about. It never means, it won't mean they get excited about Biden, but it may not be quite the massive barrier that it is right now.
I mean, I feel like what I'm seeing or hearing too is a push for, from the administration, from the White House, for an international conference to put pressure on Netanyahu in particular, but you know, where there are external players, where the conversation begins, and you don't wait for Netanyahu. So, and the Europeans will be on board with that, it seems to me. And key players in the region clearly want that, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Egypt. So, I mean, he's got another tool, it seems to me, to play.
And I just because it happens to be what I wrote about today, I think this decision by the administration to give Benny Gantz, who's a member of the Israeli War Cabinet, who has often been at odds with Netanyahu, access to three of the top officials in the country, mm-hmm. Harris, Blinken, and Jake Sullivan, is a really interesting one because the message it sends to Netanyahu is, we'll meet with people who you're openly at odds with. Yeah. I think that's an interesting message, and it suggests to me that their level of impatience and frustration with Netanyahu is now fairly deep.
Should we take another round of questions? I think we should, and there's a lot of hands.
How about the woman right back there in the center? Yeah.
Hi, I'm Tatiana, and I'm a general course student from UCLA. And I'm curious about to what extent you think relations with Russia and recent developments will play a role in the next election, given that Trump has a markedly better relationship with Putin and can maybe leverage that as a political strategy. And when I say recent developments, I mean the war and also the general political tension in Russia with the death of Alexei Navalny.
Very good. Okay, let's take this gentleman right down here, if you're patient.
Hi, I'm Dan. As you can probably tell, I'm American. So I definitely agree with the caution that at this point, primary polling isn't predictive of much, but maybe we can get some kind of early weather forecast here. On the other hand, I think that a lot of the horse race coverage in the media kind of does make mountains out of molehills, even if it's just a data point here. There was a poll over the weekend.
Question?
Yes. So I'm trying to put two things together. On the one hand, we are seeing low turnout across the board. And on the other hand, we're seeing protest votes. I'm trying to fit those two things together, because on the one hand, with Republicans, be it a third-party candidate, a candidate who's not Trump, I've heard talk of conservative firewalls in the past. We didn't really see that materialize in 2016, 2020. I'm skeptical that we're going to see it materialize now. And on the other hand, I believe you would raise with Obama in the past that uncommitted votes, actually, for example, in Michigan, I think in 2012 it was 11% of the voter base. Right. This year it was 13%. So I'm trying to put those two things together, low turnout and these protest votes.
Okay. And we'll take this woman right here, and then I'll go to you, Chris.
Hi, my name is Ellie, and I'm an A-level politics student. I was just wondering, in regards to Trump's flexibility with his vice president, is there anyone you have in mind that could kind of snatch up those Haley votes?
Snatch up the what vote?
Haley votes.
Chris.
So another question from online. Are we likely to witness a continuation of the trend of decreasing split ticket voters in this election? And if so, what implications would this have? Thank you.
I didn't catch it. Which
decreasing
vote?
split ticket.
Oh, yeah. It's a long-term trend. A lot of good questions. Ukraine, split ticket voting.
Haley vote.
That question,
Haley vote.
And that question was low turnout plus protest, like squaring the circle. Who's going to square the circle? Why don't we start with you?
Yeah, so first of the Haley, vice presidents traditionally don't matter that much. I mean, maybe when we looked at McCain's choice of Palin, that sort of mattered for many people. But other than that, I doubt that Trump will pick someone who will appeal to Haley voters. I'm skeptical of that that proposition. This point about turnout and low turnout coupled with this sort of these other dynamics, right, going on with protest voting. I mean, primary voting is, these are the most committed people voting, right? These are not individuals who, independents generally don't vote at high rates in any kind of primaries, right? And so I think one of the things that could explain this, right, is that it didn't matter, right? We knew that Trump and Biden were going to win, right? So their respective primaries. So yes, you can go protest vote, but that won't make any difference. So it's kind of rational, right, not to really turn out to vote for a primary that really won't matter. And so that's kind of my sense of what's going on there. And yes, the most committed people are always going to vote, and that slice is going to turn out and vote against Trump, right, and the Republican primary.
What about going for a VP candidate that, like, somehow divides or has the potential to peel off Biden voters, like Tim Scott?
Well, yeah, I mean, so Tim Scott quickly endorsed Trump, right, after he dropped out in a way that seemed kind of odd, right, given what happened. Again, this sort of theme of that I mentioned earlier about working class blacks and Latinos going towards the Republicans. In terms of like a Latino candidate, it would be like a Marco Rubio or someone like that, who was his opponent in 2016, which possibly could be if he's interested in sort of pursuing that route. I don't think that, though, would solve the issue of the Haley voters.
No.
Right? So that's the concern. Yeah, it's like oil and water, right? So, yeah. So yeah, I mean, I think, or Tim Scott certainly trying to appeal to black voters who, yes, the majority will continue to vote for Biden, but if you can slice off a few, especially in those swing states like Michigan, right, then it could make a difference.
Ursula?
Yeah, well, I would say I had a couple of points just on the turnout as well. I would maybe pick up some of these things that Jason's been mentioning here. I mean, I think Jason's right. I mean, this is the fact that this is the outcome was not really in doubt. I think is probably going to have a depressive effect here. But the two things I would mention, one is that recently, 2018, 2020, 2022, we've had some really high, relatively high turnout elections. I think it's quite likely that this is going to be in that same trend line. And I would say also that if you look at some of the open primaries, you see some involvement of independents on behalf of some of the protest options on either side that maybe, you know, suggests that, again, suggestive, I think, of a higher turnout in fall when you've got an electorate that's the whole of the electorate rather than this unusual primary electorate. So I agree with a lot of what Jason was saying just there. But I was interested, this point about the split ticket voting, which came in online, I thought that was kind of interesting. One question, and I don't actually have an answer to this, is I saw some recent commentary that was suggesting that So we know that there's a kind of a coattail effect, a kind of a down ballot sweeping the someone comes out for the top of the ballot and then they maybe that has an effect down the ballot, maybe suggesting that effect could be reversed, that there could be an up ballot kind of effect if people are, you look really skeptical, Peter.
Yeah.
Well, just that maybe some of these races which are going on in the states that people are sort of, there are some local issues that maybe there are some issues things that are happening at the state level, certain candidates at the state level that are maybe having, that might help to draw Biden support as well, and so sort of bolster that. But I don't know whether people give any credence to that thought.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason I think I'm skeptical is I think I don't know where I saw this. It might have been the New York Times, that there's only like 8 House seats that are truly in play. That everything else is just basically locked up on both sides, you know. So, Stephanie.
Let me speak maybe on the Russian question, if I may.
Okay, yeah.
It seems like what's cutting through from Trump on Russia seems to be this argument about we don't want to be the world's policeman. Everybody has to pay their share of the NATO budget. So that seems to be the message that's getting through, not, you know, that I'm friends with Russia, and you know, but it seems to be this argument, we're tired of being the world's policeman. Everybody else needs to pay their fair share. And that's part of this more global, or this broader trend that we see, this dialing back of America's leadership in the world, this sort of anti-globalist, you know, let's withdraw from the World Trade Organization, let's withdraw from NATO. And that seems to be cutting through, and it's part of the message that's attracting some of his base. And so that's what I take away from the Russia situation. Can I just say one quick word? Wouldn't it be so clever to get Haley to be his VP? Now, she's ruled that out, but I think she maybe has ruled it out because she's looking ahead to 2028.
Yeah.
She's well-placed now to be a 2028 candidate, potentially, on the GOP ticket.
She probably has to endorse him, though, at some point. Mark.
I just would make a couple of additional points on Russia. I think I would draw a distinction between Israel, Gaza, and Ukraine, Russia. Israel-Gaza is an issue that is so emotive that I think people cast votes based on it. I'm not sure that many people will cast a vote based on Russia. So I think of Russia more in the context of potential disruption of the electoral process. Mm-hmm. You remember they did that in 2016, and we'd be smart to be very careful to guard against that happening again. You know, I think Stephanie makes a very good point about how Russia plays into Trump's worldview. And Biden, no doubt, will, as part of his attack on Trump, point out that Trump has this unerring affinity for strongmen and anti-democratic figures. So it isn't just Putin, it's Xi Jinping, it's Kim Jong-un in North Korea, it's Erdogan in Turkey, it's a whole range, Orban in Hungary, it's a whole range of anti-democratic and pretty bad guys. So, you know, Russia will figure in the debate as another one of those black hats. But I don't think at the end of the day, a conflict that's happening pretty far away from the US, to which we have deployed no combat troops, at the end of the day, is really going to be that important an electoral issue.
Let's take a few more questions. We're going to do this quickly because we're running out of time. We'll take this woman right down here.
Hi, thank you. My name's Anne McLaughlin. I'm an MP for the best city in the UK, which is Glasgow. We've heard that there's a lot of mistrust, or a significant number of people are not trusting politics anymore. And we've heard about how unusual this situation is because it's incumbent versus incumbent. Could the panelists all say if they could find themselves an independent who they felt would be strong enough to possibly win the presidential election and cut through all of this, who would they select as their independent candidate? Oh, it has to be somebody who's not a politician. Because I was thinking about Zelensky, who used to be a comedian before he became president of Ukraine.
Thanks. Go ahead.
My name is Prajwal. I'm a SOAS alumni. My question is, what will be the role of abortion in deciding the support of women voters? And what would be the role of the other culture war issues in shaping the narrative leading to the election?
I'll take one last question right back there, this gentleman.
Hi, thanks very much. I think we heard a little bit from Ursula on this already, but I'd like to hear the rest of the panel's opinions on the money question. How has Biden's relative strength in that, has that likely to play out in the panel's view?
Mark, why don't we start down there?
With which?
Anyone?
Which topic?
Well, I mean, on the money question, it's a significant and important advantage, and it'll be interesting to see whether he actually continues to build on it, because a lot of money that Trump's various PACs have raised has ended up being, plowed into his legal defense fund. And he's not having the kind of success he had in prior cycles with raising small donations. There was an interesting moment in the last couple of days where Elon Musk went to Mar-a-Lago and met with Trump, and that sparked a lot of speculation about what would happen if the world's richest man decided to bankroll Donald Trump. It's not going to happen, but that doesn't mean we couldn't see other less conspicuous examples of the same thing. You know, there are a lot of the Koch brothers, for example, were putting their money into Nikki Haley until recently. So there are resources on the Republican side that are huge and could be deployed for Trump. But you know, some of those people have been reluctant so far. Again, to go back to my line about Republicans falling in line, once he is officially the nominee, will some of the resistance of these people drop, in which case he could find himself quite well funded. But you know, this is one area where Biden looks relatively good right now, and he will continue to raise a lot of money.
I don't have an answer for your question. As you know, coming from Scotland, the electoral system sets up two parties to compete. But in American Samoa, which voted last night, a business person won and beat Trump. Now, that's not going to change anything, but an independent candidate won. Very interesting in the Republican primary. I just want to say one word about abortion. It is one of these issues. Some people are single issue voters on abortion. And I think the change, having Roe v. Wade overturned, may really make a larger percentage of women in the states a single issue voter on this topic, which would unarguably hurt Trump.
Yeah, so lots of great questions. Let's see, which one should I talk about, Peter?
How about the possibility of like some kind of independent?
Independent, yeah. I think someone like a Dwayne The Rock Johnson or something like this would be, I think someone from that kind of non-political background could possibly, but no, I mean, as we were just talking about, the system is set up for a two-party, for a two-party, so it's very difficult, obviously, for anyone who's third party to win because of the Electoral College.
I mean, I would just, on that particular point, too, I think the no-label party is supposed to announce on Friday whether or not they're going to put a candidate forward, and they're going to have trouble because Haley told them no, Chris Christie told them no, Joe Manchin told them no as an independent. It's awfully hard to field an independent candidate in the United States. It's a duopoly.
Mm-hmm. I'll speak very, very briefly on the money question as well, which is that I broadly agree with Mark's analysis, and it really is quite striking the extent to which the DNC and Biden have outstripped the RNC and Trump in terms of their fundraising, in terms of the cash they actually have on hand and not tied up in these legal shenanigans. Let's not forget that the ability of the Trump campaign to actually fundraise based around some of these moments where he's had these big court appearances or the mugshot, the day of the mugshot, they bring in this huge quantity of donations. They do have that ability to kind of, to sort of punch through and to gain a lot of small dollar donations that add up in those circumstances. So I'm not saying that it's going to overturn that advantage, but it's just that it's quite striking that some of these appearances have been such incredible fundraising opportunities for Trump. But the question of abortion as well, I mean, I think that's right. I think it is going to play into the fall, but also I think as part of a broader concern about the Supreme Court and this court, which is Trump's court substantially in the sense that he elevated three of the current justices who have been voting together on a lot of these issues. And I think that it's not just about the abortion issue, but also other culture war issues, gun rights, for example, which is coming up in the current term. And there's a lot of really controversial cases that are going to be handed down. I don't know how they're going to actually ultimately come down on this. But the rights of domestic abusers to own firearms and things, and a lot of these things that are really quite provocative to a certain segment of the electorate.
So we only just have a few minutes left. I mean, maybe just to ask you, each of you, kind of going forward, what's one thing that you're just going to be keeping your eye on for, the coming weeks, coming months, that you're kind of in your mind is like a key kind of indicator that we should be paying attention to? Who wants to go first? Mark.
Well, can I just make one last question on culture wars? I think that it is instructive and interesting that Ron DeSantis ran a primary campaign that was largely built around being, the ultimate enemy of woke culture, Florida, where woke goes to die. He floundered completely. Now, that I don't think that says that culture war issues don't have resonance, but it's certainly a question worth exploring because his candidacy kind of belly flopped, and it was built around on culture war issues. Right. In terms of, it's not so much an issue that I'm watching, but just to sort of, to my mind, to finish with what I think really matters here, Donald Trump is an existential threat to democracy in America. He is a completely out of bounds, norm-busting, corrupt grifter. He's unlike anyone who's ever attempted to be president. And I think all of us need to remember that every single day. And I say that as someone who works in the press, where the instinct is to weigh things carefully and to be even-handed and to give both sides a shake. And I'm not saying that we should abandon these principles, but we should remember that the stakes in this election are truly enormous, greater perhaps, and I know people say this about every election, I truly believe it's true this time, greater than any we've faced. And so it's easy to kind of have these and useful to have these analytical discussions, but it's worth remembering that if Trump is elected, we will experience a presidency unlike any that we've had in this country, and I don't believe the United States will come easily back to where it was after four more years of this.
I will be carefully watching the economy, and not only what the economy does, but what Biden attempts to do in the remaining time he has left to manipulate the economy or try to stimulate the economy. Are there new policy levers he could pull or try to use to help grow the economy or help these places that are being left behind, like Nevada with that 5% unemployment rate?
Real quickly, I mean, I think looking at the discourse around age, and in particular, we didn't talk much about this, but the way that both campaigns portray the vice presidential candidates, I think Trump will run heavily against Kamala Harris as that she will become the president if you vote for Biden. And so that's something we didn't talk about, but I think how that's played, I think, will be something I'm curious to watch. And of course, whoever Trump picks as the vice president, I think because of his age as well, I think it's going to matter more than usual.
Ursula, you get the last word.
Well, I suppose I think that although we might talk about some of these banner numbers on favorability and so on as being indicators, I think this really comes down to those swing states, those very, very small number of swing states, and we have to put our focus there in terms of who's actually going to ultimately triumph in November.
The stakes are huge, I agree with that, and we're going to be revisiting this issue and this race here at LSE a number of times between now and November. And I want to thank all of you for coming here this evening. Please join me in thanking all of our panelists. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.